Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Songwriter Soup.
And I remember walking through with Amos Newman, my manager, and be like, do you see the tiger over there? And I'm like, is there an elephant behind me? And he's like, yes. I'm like, are we in a room with a bunch of these animals right now?
Healthy recipes for not losing your mind and your money in the songwriter business.
You know, every day is not going to be the best song in the whole world, but we believe that tomorrow might
Could be.
Presented by American Songwriter.
Welcome to Songwriter Soup. I'm Laura Veltz. This podcast is for songwriters out there trying to manage their way through this little funny career. This season is full of friends of ours who've just really made their way through, managed to find success, but also have such interesting stories. And this episode is about Lori McKenna, who is one of our absolute greats. She's like our den mother for Music Row. She represents so much to so many people, and this podcast episode really means a lot to me. I hope you enjoy it. So were you always an artist? Was the artist pursuit, did it precede your interest in writing for other people?
So when I started the artist thing, I guess it was in order to get the songs out.
Oh, interesting.
But because I'm not really, my favorite part of it all is songwriting. So, but I'm up there in Boston. I don't know, even at that point, I don't even think I knew that people could just be songwriters. Not just be, you know.
No, I
hate to use the word just, but
hey, I put that just on a pedestal.
I love
all
the just.
Time.
Yeah.
Just is great. I'm into just.
Yeah. But I didn't know that that was a job, you know, and it took me a long time to figure that out. But I think that the using the artistry as a vehicle was sort of my only option at that point. Because when I started writing songs when I was young, but I didn't even share them with my siblings, really, and my close friends until I had three kids, you know. And I always say the kids, like, gave me, you know, that at that point, you know, they gave me the confidence to be like, well, you might as well share. You've shared all these other things. And I think there's, like, a thing, as you know, about songs where we are not just satisfied just being the only people that hear our songs. There's something else that is necessary for us to share. I guess it's like loving yourself. Like, loving yourself is one thing, but loving other people is so much better.
How beautiful. And so true. You know, it's like a...
It's just part of the process.
Share. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you were a full-fledged family before this whole thing really began. You were likely financially stable at this point. So you weren't like, you know, working at Burger King, probably not.
Right? I was working. My brother has an epoxy company, and okay. I was working there. I was not a school person. I was always trying to get out of school, so I did. I was like, I'll take a job over here, and then I could do. It was called work study, and you went to school like 3 hours in the morning, and then you went to work.
Okay,
and then went to like first year of community college. 19, pregnant, gets married. And I looked like I was 14. So I was like, at community college, like pregnant. They're like, who's the 14-year-old? Like, who's the pregnant 14-year-old, like, in community college? Like, so I looked like a genius, you know, that skipped all these grades in high school, but somehow got pregnant. But so I stopped school because I never really knew what I was doing with school anyway. It's like, it was a means to an end. But I still always worked with my brother. I worked there for like 17 years, and I would just, every time I had a baby, I would change my job. And Gene, my husband's a plumber, so he always, at that point, it was like he just worked his way up through plumbing companies, but would be laid off a good part of the year, you know, all that.
Right.
We bought a house like right up the street from where we grew up, and it took us like a year to be able to actually live in the house. You know, it was one of those houses. And we just lived with my dad for a long time. And we did the whole, like, what bill should we pay this month?
Right.
You know, we did that for a long time. But we also had three kids by the time we were 25. And I was working, like, I remember making $5,000 a year. But I did everything. I did, like, I needed a car, so I, like, sold Tupperware. I'm like, if I can make $350 a month, I can get a car. You know what I mean? Something like that. We did all that.
That's amazing.
So, and that was all in those years. So then when I was like, hey, I went to this open mic and someone told me that I should save $5,000 and make a record. My Gene was like, oh, yeah? Like, how are you going to do that? But we did it. You know what I mean? And then one led to another. And it was just looking back on that, those were, I don't know how we did it. I really don't. But it was fun, too. But we always had the security of, like, literally my dad. I could walk to my dad's house,
right.
My parents' house. You know,
that's beautiful.
That my stepmom and my dad still live in the house we grew up in. And so it's like they, I always had like a, like somebody saying, if you need something, call me and I'll help you.
And at what point were you like plugged in here? Because it seems like, honestly, as a songwriter and a fan who got here later, mm-hmm. it seems like you've always been here.
Yeah.
It seems like there was never a point in history where Lori McKenna wasn't destroying things. Like, and just like breaking songwriter hearts left and right. Yeah, like you seem like a staple. So I'm personally curious, like, at what point was it like I'm a member of this community, even though you don't live here, which is very interesting and tough for most people.
Well, this community is so loving. Mm-hmm. You know, and I grew up in the Boston community, which is another loving community, because I'm not good with competition and things like that. I would just like have stayed home if Boston didn't have a great musical vibe, you know. So I made the record Bitter Town, 2004 comes out, and Mary Gaucher calls me and says, can I share this record that you've made with a woman I know, Melanie Howard, who's a publisher. And by that summer, like, I'm literally like in my backyard, like chasing kids, and she called and she's like, Faith Hill wants to hear every song you've written.
Fuck.
So I haven't left Massachusetts. I haven't left my yard because I just had a child. So like, so literally that all happened. Like, I always say, like, David was, you know, he's just my, like, I just kept having kids and God was like, well, we got to get rid, we got to do something. And he's like my good luck charm. But yeah, by Thanksgiving of that year, she cut a few of those songs that were on that record, which came out 2005. So at this point, I had been to Nashville twice.
Mm. Any public? Do you have a publishing deal at this point? At
not
all?
Yet.
Okay. Were any of these songs co-written?
No. Oh, I had never co-written a song at that point.
Lord have mercy.
And so by 2005 was when I was coming here a couple of times. I had probably signed my deal with Melanie Howard by the end of 2004 or beginning of 2005. And sort of just all worked through, like, I don't know anybody that's done this before. Even Mary didn't have a proper publishing deal because she was doing it all on her own. She may have had an admin deal. I have no idea. But I didn't really know anybody. I didn't know Liz Rose or Hillary Lindsay or Barry Dean or you to call and be what is this thing? You know, how does this work? But that just all rolled, you know, it just rolled into a record deal. And then I made a record. And so I was just from that point coming flying in here like once a month. Like I said to Gene, I'm like, let's just try this out for a little while and see what happens. You know, like I kept thinking like, if I'm turning these corners and like there's another like road that way, but it looks pretty awesome. Mm-hmm. And it's really brightly lit and it's not that dark and it
natural.
Doesn't seem
like,
yeah. And yeah. So, and every time I did something uncomfortable. And when I say I mean Gene.
Right.
The whole family.
Yeah. Family house.
I mean Gene too. But it's like when I would talk him into something, like, let's try this. There was always I use the word reward, but there was always a blessing or something like, you were supposed to do that. Like, maybe that wasn't exactly what you thought, but look over there. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I literally say this all the time is, my greatest friends, adult friends, certainly, have been through music. It's like, it wasn't just, you know, this job that I love and having some financial stability. It was these people that I love, mm-hmm. that I don't know how I would get through life without, you know? And those were always around, some sort of like risky little, mm-hmm. is this a dumb idea? Should we really be doing this? You know? But it always worked out.
That first deal with Melanie, did you have, reflect back on that, and did you have a clue what you were signing at that point?
Did I kind of did.
What kind of deal was it?
It was a publishing deal. It wasn't co-pub, but the songs that Faith had cut, I had already written, so those were co-pub.
Okay. Did you have half of your publishing on those?
On those, I did.
Yeah. So those came in. Those came in.
Mm-hmm. So you had like a Schedule A kind of a thing.
Everything I wrote after that was publishing. I don't think I even knew there was co-pub deals at that point. It was explained to me like, here's the writer's share, here's the publisher. Not to be like, say anything. I don't think I was misled, but
were. It's fine. We can talk about it.
Oh, no, you were.
Yes, you were.
But doesn't everybody have a really bad, doesn't everybody have a...
Yes, that's why, that's why there's a whole chapter. and everybody goes through it, right?
Yeah,
what we see.
It's like taxes. It's like it's complicated on purpose so that we are like, I don't know what to do. TurboTax, help me. It's that way on purpose. And, you know, maybe it won't be in the future, but fully sure that, you know, it's worded in ways, it's not explained properly, it's all there, it's baked in, so that we don't really know what we're signing. And but it's like we all do it, like literally, I don't know a single person who knows exactly what they're signing, like to this day, like right before they sign that first shitty deal.
Yeah. I think it's probably the words like recoupable and what's a demo and like who pays for the demo, and then even the whole math. I mean, I'm still figuring things out, but those are pretty much the only songs in that catalog that I really did have cut. Tim cut a song, and I wrote a song with Sarah Evans, or maybe that was an older song, but there was a couple other songs. It was a 4-year agreement, but the bulk of that were those original Faith songs.
So you did end up making, like, you recoup. Did you? When did you recoup?
I didn't not recoup. Like,
were always recouped.
Yeah, because there was no advance. There was no, like.
You didn't take an advance.
No. I mean, there was a draw, but it was very small.
Okay.
So there was all. So when that record came out, which was Fireflies 2005. Like, by whenever that would have turned around, it was, you know, like, but I had never seen, you know, I remember getting that check, you know what I mean? And it being like, I brought it home and Gene's like, is that real? Like, what do you do with something like this?
You're the Pooh Bear you're Winnie the Pooh of Music Row. Like, everything, like, I love that your story so far is already just so freaking compelling. Like,
oh yeah.
The Schedule A happened to be the songs that recouped you immediately. You've never been unrecouped.
On that deal, my next deal, I'm sure I was unrecouped for a while.
What's funny, the reason I bring up Winnie the Pooh is because every one of us, I had a Schedule A. And in my head, those songs were going to be like the exceptions. Oh, these are going to get cut. They're going to get cut. And then I'm going to have co-pub. And there is not one red penny made
came
on my Schedule
A.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is this is incredible. The fact that the songs that you came in with actually did something and actually made you any money. I mean, I think that's part of like the publishing misleading. It's like not misleading. I mean, I'm not saying people are evil or anything, but there is something when they're like, oh no, you can have publishing on these songs. I know the first person who offered me that was going, she's never going to make any money on these songs. Like, they gave it to me like they were trying to sweeten the pot. But in my career, it sweetened nothing. It made them no money. It made me no money. So, and that's most people.
Yeah.
Everybody has this schedule. Like, you brought in whatever. You can have co-pub on those junky little pieces of shit that you know, and then you feel good about yourself, but then they never make any money. I'm floored that your Schedule A on your first deal. That's just fucking amazing.
Well, that's because that's what Faith heard.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Those were the songs that Faith heard. And I basically got my publishing deal because of Faith.
Of it.
If Faith didn't cut those songs, I may have had a publishing deal, but I may not have either. It might have been like, well, you gave it a shot.
you know?
Yeah.
Because at that point, all those songs had already been.
It was already baked in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I really do think. The songs I co-wrote after, there was just a handful in the rest of those years. And I do remember hearing the same thing, like, oh, somebody else will come along, find that catalog and like cut all those things. You're fine, you know?
Right.
But Melanie was smart for me. When I look back on that, like, like the things that could have been better for a newbie, I think are balanced out by the great things that she did for me, which is put me with Mark D, mm-hmm. put me with Liz Rose. You know what I mean? Like Brandi Clark was an early co-writer for me.
Brilliant.
And I think she knew like, oh, here's this like 36-year-old that's never co-written a song. I think I had co-written one song, literally, my whole life. And she doesn't really know how to do this, so I'll put her with the best. And they were just really good friends to me right in the beginning and told me yeah. stuff that, you know, that I should know.
Incredible.
But then I came to love it here. I love co-writing. Like that was a whole other thing, is people were like, you're so old. Like you can't start co-writing now. It's going to totally mess you up. Mm-hmm. But I never had any expectations. Like I hadn't even like researched the whole thing enough. I didn't really know anybody that lived that journey, you know, being disappointed by
it's amazing
by this town. So I was like, I'm just going to see what happens for myself. And instead of co-writing shutting me down, it was completely the other way. That's where I found my community.
And it's probably why, Lori. Like, it's probably why. Something we talk a ton about is expectations. And
yeah,
the more you come in with, the more brutally rebuffed you are, especially in the beginning, and the less fun it is when you actually hit milestones. I mean, there's so much wisdom in how you just lived naturally. Just, oh, maybe I'll see.
And open.
That's
open.
Really nice of you to call it wisdom and following.
It is.
I was just lucky.
Wise.
I mean, so much luck. But I know there's that whole phrase about like luck has to meet hard work or whatever. And that's what, you know, I was like, well, I know how to write songs and I know how to I know how to get on a plane. Mm-hmm. I know how to book a ticket.
Yeah.
And so for years and years, I would just come back once or twice a month. Mostly that would be my writing because I didn't write. I write alone a lot, but I didn't have people coming up to Massachusetts at that point. Mm-hmm. And I would I stayed with Melanie for most of that first deal. And then I moved to Universal and I stayed with Liz Rose. And so, which was in a way, it's kind of like when I think about not having a home here early, I think it was a blessing for me because it's like... this is a bad example because I don't want Liz to hear this be like, did you compare me to a grandparent? it's like when a grandparent moves in and that you see that relationship that a grandparent has with a grandchild that they wouldn't have if they didn't live with each other or on top of each other. Or like in our case, like my stepmom watched our kids for us when I worked and my mother-in-law did. And you see that connection that normally, you know, you don't have that unless you're like living underfoot of someone. I was really living with Liz, you know, for 6 or 8 days a month for years and years and years.
I'm curious about your first hit and your first entrance into the like the rooms where you're like, oh my God, that's a whole lot of fancy people. Like, I feel like something we have in common is a little bit of like, who cares? But I'm like about that world mm-hmm. of like glitz and the fancy version of living here. We actually got BMI awards on the same day, which makes no sense to me again because you were all in my head. You were just always everywhere. You were like in the water. But we got our first BMI awards on the same day. We were like, the first winners.
We
come
got
on up
and take a picture. Yeah,
got up
That's
together.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And my experience with that was bizarre. I'm curious what that kind of experience was for you when you started really like being around the fancy version of what this world includes. Like, what was that like?
The fancy versions are always like, because I spent so much time with the McGraws and all that because I went, I toured with them. The first night of I guess it was the original Soul to Soul. Mm. Right. And we were in Nebraska and the night before there was rehearsals in the arena and the circus was coming. Like the circus was happening like next.
Oh, and, behind you the next night.
Yeah. And so all the caravan of all that like pulled up and there was these big, huge, like empty rooms with like, tigers and shit in it. Like, oh my, like straight up. Like, and I remember walking, and I had my kid, I had my oldest Brian, and I had my two youngest, because David was a baby. David was, had just turned three. And my daughter was with my, I have one girl, and she was there. She was six. And I remember walking through with Amos Newman, my manager, and be like, do you see the tiger over there? And I'm like, is there an elephant behind me? And he's like, yes. I'm like, are we in a room with a bunch of these animals right now?
Oh my God.
I had so many moments like that. Like, and for so long, it was like the day before Christmas in my life for so many years. Every time we were on the Macross, something was going to happen. And I always felt like, I still feel like this, and we are probably, everybody does, but I still feel like I'm just like holding my head above water.
Always.
Especially in a creative room, you know, like I'm always doing, I'm blessed to be able to somebody say, do you want to, you know, fly to Malibu next week and write with this pops person? Mm-hmm. And I'm doing the stupidest, like Laurie things, like from Stone, Massachusetts. And, you know, like Cindy Crawford lives over there, and you're like, okay, I'm just going to use the bathroom. I don't know. Like, I'm always in those situations, but they're so fun. You know what I mean? And in all that, you just like, you just want to rhyme okay that mm-hmm. day. You know what I mean? And so I think all those things have become like, I look back on them more than I can absorb them in the moment. And as I've gotten old, I've become older, even playing shows, I really try to like sit in it. You know, the first time I played the Opry, I remember doing all the interviews and they were like, is your family here? Did you bring everybody? I'm like, no, I didn't think that I should do that, because I didn't know like this was really happening. Like, I was expecting like, you know. So I think that those moments, and I remember the BMI thing that you're talking about, and that was for I Want Crazy with Hunter Hayes, that I wrote with Troy Burgess and Hunter Hayes, and that was my first number one. Mm-hmm. And I think it was maybe my first time at the BMIs, or maybe second, because mm-hmm. I was a guest with Liz, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But I remember the number one party for that. They, you know, everyone gets up and talks, and someone had said it was my first number one, and Dan Huff came up to me afterwards. He's like, this is your first number one?
Yeah, it was bizarre.
And I was like, I think so. Like, I don't know. I'm just like, here for the ride.
God.
But he said the same thing to me. He's like, it just seems like you're always hanging around.
Always here. It's almost like, I think we just, maybe we just needed you. And when you were, I'm serious. Like, the town needs a sane, sort of calm person like you. And I feel like you also are so maternal. You obviously have a brood. And I think that, for me, you know, we're the same age probably, but there was something very maternal. I think we're close. But like, there was something maternal about your energy that I think was also part of why it was like, no, she's a founding father. I don't understand why we're up here on the same stage receiving the first of anything. I don't understand.
It's like the stories we tell ourselves about everybody else. You know, like, it's like Barry Dean for me. I just imagine. And every time Hillary tells a story, I'm like, you were in high school then, right? Like, when you were with Lady Gaga that time, you were in high school, right? Like, that was high school, right? Because she, to me, she's always been here, but she came here for college. Yeah. And it's like all those things. I just figure, like, with my story, like, everything I've figured out, or there's really somebody figuring out for me what happened at the right time. Like, I'm sort of like a late bloomer anyway. I feel like I'm not ready to go anywhere. So I'm just going to like ride it out. And, you know, I'm not in a hurry, and I'm not awesome. Pulling over either. Right, you know, like I just sort of, that's how I drive. I'm going to get perfect. There.
The image I keep thinking of with you, and, you know, each person we've talked to has a different kind of like color on them, different energy. But the thing I keep imagining with your career and probably your whole life is like, you have this tiny little 1 foot, 2 foot long red carpet that just like rolls out right before your next step. And it's like, oh, well then I guess I'll take a little steppy, and then roop, and then you're like, ba-boop. And that like balance of expectation and not thinking anything is that important. I think that's a good portion of what's coming off of you too. And I wish we could just bottle this up and give it out as pills at Belmont, because enjoying the journey is the whole fucking point of this book.
The whole point.
And I just wish we could bottle you. I just wish we could bottle the way you've
your presence
done this. Like, yeah.
Well, being present it, in those moments. Mm-hmm. Is,
well, that's what I'm learning. I really like had, and Brian, my oldest, is like, you know, found meditation a while back and all these things. So I'm learning. Sorry. I'm as always, I'm learning how to not hit a microphone. I'm learning from my kids, like more than anybody, you know, like our kids will, you know, those kids will teach you things. And so that continues. But I do have to, because when I don't try to just balance myself in the minute and take a deep breath, I don't enjoy it as much. Exactly. Like you just can't take it in.
Exactly.
And I've done that a million times.
Yeah, it's like the whole push-pull. You kind of like get stuck in there. Do you have any people in your life who are established songwriters or artists who, and please no names, obviously, but like who you would think would be happy? You would think would be in the state that you're in of like, this is supposed to be fun. And they just cannot seem to like find their joy in the stage they're in, because it's a big portion of why we started writing this is that my experience with some of the older writers is this bitterness that comes with, you know, either you need the number one, you need the number one. Oh shit, the number one's over.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I want to be rich. Oh, it's over now. I have to make sure it stays. Like all of those intense emotions, like, have you found there's a variety of types around you, or like, shouldn't everyone be happy is kind of where
it seems like
it should be, but what do you attribute to that?
I don't see a ton of that. And I think it's like, when I think of the people that like lived through, I guess it would have been the 90s, right? Where like, I mean, you were just buying an island or something, right?
With your,
as songwriters, there was so much money. We miss that. So it's like, so I don't miss it, you know, because we weren't here for that.
Good point.
You know, like you can't miss it because you didn't experience it. But I have heard people talk about that, you know, like back in the day and all those things. But the people that I work with that went through that or experienced that or were blessed by that, whatever way you want to say it. Like Tom Douglas comes to mind because he is such an adapter. Like I've never heard Tom say anything bitter in my whole life, but I do have a record called Bitter Town, but I try to, I am not drawn to people that have bitterness. Like I think it's like the first energy that I know how to stay away from. And I just don't know, like just by mistake, I didn't teach myself. I just was lucky enough to be like, that doesn't feel right to me.
Right.
But when I think about Tom and the people that I know that had really great, you know, saw all that, like, I can't imagine that Tom doesn't love every day in his life, that he doesn't see everything, you know, everything that he has. And I've talked to Tom about this, about songs. It's like, okay, if this song today isn't the best song like we've ever written and didn't, like we missed something, we don't know what we missed, but like, we can write a song tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Like this is the thing about songs is like, or if this part of this situation we didn't nail it. Mm-hmm. The thing is, we can try to nail it tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, we're all writing a song again the next day. Like if you write I Can't Make You Love Me every day, eventually you're gonna be like, is there a better song? Like, should we like or in Tom's case, House That Built Me, like, you know, every day is not gonna be the best song in the whole world, but we believe that tomorrow might be.
That's an incredibly hopeful
approach.
But that's how you have to be, right? Yes. So, and the people that I'm around, I feel like that's how they feel too. For me, I think there was something nice about not living here, because I am a person that has a little bit of song FOMO, in the way that if I had the day off today and I bumped into you at Starbucks, like, oh, Laura, it's so good to see you. What are you doing today? And you said, oh, I'm going to write with Hillary Lindsay today. I'd be like, oh, can I come? Like, there's so many songwriters here.
Yeah.
And so many great songwriters that we love so much and love their work, that I would overwrite if I lived here. I feel like my experience with bitterness isn't necessarily fair, because I never ran myself into the ground trying to be that creative, which I think if you live here and you're not careful,
you're right,
can happen. Like, it's not even that you do it to yourself, it just can happen because you want you just want to take it all in, you know?
And the math, you start thinking like, if I wrote two a day or three a day, then maybe the odds of me, but I know that's a lot of how some writers work is just numbers. They're like, if I write 10 songs, one of them will likely get cut. If one of them gets cut, then maybe one of the 10 songs, like that'll be a single, like, and it's just math. So, but yeah, I think there are definitely so many ways to do this. And your way is definitely the way I like to approach songwriting, in that I want to always want to be there.
And I think also, like, I have friends, and Hillary said this to me, because over this past year, we've been Zoom writing, and I've never written every day, and I've written almost every day.
Wow.
You know, Monday, and I've had weekends. It's like, wait a minute, Saturday? This is what people do on Saturday? They like, because normally, like, we would have a show or something. And so I've enjoyed writing. Like, I feel like I'm in writing boot camp right now, because I'm like, you know, like working out every day. Which I don't work out, but knowing where you are, because then I'll get on the phone with Hillary after we both write, and like talk on the phone at 5 o'clock after the day, and she'll say, you're writing too much. Like, if you thought that, you need to probably slow down. Like, you need to know yourself enough in the whole creative process too, where you could have had a better day if you weren't writing too much. That you would have enjoyed that more if you weren't writing too much. And
that's great.
That takes, I mean,
self-awareness.
Exactly.
People do need to hear
that.
That trust that everything is going to be fine.
Well, also, I had the luxury of, like I said, like those parents that would help us out. You know what I mean? And Jean always have, you know, being so stable. And I know a lot of people don't have of those things.
Yes.
But I think the answer is still the same.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the result is still the answer is still, don't overwork your creative spirit, or you will not like it at some point. And I know my story is like sort of a blessed story, and it had that, you know, that really strong foundation for me to see that maybe earlier than I would have if I hadn't, you know, had all that support. But the answer is the same.
Yeah, it is. And at the same time, and by the same token, there's going to be someone who's listening right now. I can even think, not right this minute, this isn't live. but like someone who would hear this and go, that's not me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a grind guy. That's who I am.
Right.
And to me, I'm like, there's a place for you too. But Lori McKenna, you can still be like a Lori. Like, that's an insane thought that you can approach this from two different philosophies and still end up with a similar result, which is just like a lifer staff writer. Like, that's a...
Yeah. Everybody says the same thing. It's like, in music, our goal is to do music every day. And if we're doing music every day, like, we're successful.
Right.
Like, I'm going to have a strange relative walk up to me and say, how come Faith Hill hasn't cut any of songs lately? And it's like, I don't know. You know, I keep trying, you know, but I don't know, but I'm still doing music every day. So, and that is like, that's what we wanted, right?
That's right.
Like, that's the goal. And that's the job. Like, I tell my kids, like, I know you don't have publishing deals yet, but you're doing the job.
Yep. That's part of why we start with chapter one. Like, the first step of becoming a professional songwriter is getting a different job entirely. Like, that is when you begin. Like, you're saying, like, despite the fact that your kids don't have publishing deals, they've begun. Like, this is the beginning of their career. I just think that's...
Yeah.
I don't think that thinking any other way will make you any happier.
That's so great. That's so great what you just said. Because, like, yeah, my son, his job is to write a song today. It's not to drive Lyft for 3 hours tonight. He's got to drive Lyft for a little bit so he can pay his bills. But that's not his job.
And the identity too is a big part. We talk a lot about how discouraging it can feel when someone thinks you're a waiter. They think you're parking their whip, you know, at the fucking whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Or they think you're a Lyft driver. And having to swallow down, like, the humility that it takes to swallow that down and be like, no, this is part of how I became a songwriter. This is how I began my songwriting career. Those identity things are huge parts of how we walk through. Like, your identity as a songwriter is very weirdly fragile if you take it a certain, if you, I don't know, if you digest this job a certain way, your identity can get really lost when you're before you've made your mark and then after.
Like when you say identify, that's a whole other thing. Like I have to unpack that in my brain, but I do remember it took me a long time. If I was on a plane and somebody said, "What do you do for a living?" It took me a long time to say, "Oh, I'm a songwriter," because it was like, I didn't want to I didn't want to be like, "Well, I'm a mom. Is that gone if I use this other word?"
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, the words are tough. Is that gone?
Wow. Yeah. Lori, how cool. Is that gone if I say this? Oof.
Maybe that's why we use adjust. I'm just a mom. I'm just a songwriter. Yeah, maybe. Just a mom who's writing songs. Yeah. You know, I love the word kitchen. It's in all my songs.
As you think about Brian, and who's the other son?
Chris. Yeah.
As you think of them or even people outside of family, and you think about the kind of the next 10 years for you, what do you think of, what's your vision of that? Have you thought about like what it's like to mentor? I mean, you're pretty experienced in mentoring Brian and Chris, but mentoring other people and
I think at some point I would hope to get there. I don't feel like I have that much to offer. Like even with Brian and Chris, I really stay out of what they're doing because I don't think it would be helpful. You know what I mean? Yeah. For anybody who had a parent in that job, you know, to be like, "Oh, so-and-so is helping their kid." I don't think that's helpful at all.
Especially here because it doesn't make a difference.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And it really doesn't. It's just how you show up in the room. Mm-hmm. And they're really good, especially Chris, really good at networking. Like, you know what I mean? Like we had dinner last night. I'm like, "Who are you writing with tomorrow?" And they both like, "How did that happen?" Mm-hmm. Like, "Oh, so-and-so," you know, like they are really good at it. So it's like that's a big part of the job in the beginning. Mm-hmm. If you don't have a publisher. So, but yeah, as you know, like we're in this transition, the next couple of years are going to be, because our youngest is going to graduate high school in a couple of years. And then we live in Boston, which is cold. And so Jean wants to be warmer. So it's like, where are we all going to land? You know, one of our middle of those three boys in the beginning of time. our son Mark is a EMT up in Boston. And so he's doing a paramedic school. And then it's like, "Oh, if you were going to, would you become a firefighter in Nashville? How does Nashville sound to you?" And so it's like all that. We might maybe see if we land somewhere else, like base somewhere else. Because I'm trying to get Gene out of that job, you know.
I know you are. Right? You're going to have to dynamite him out of that job.
I know. And he you know Gene. Tracy knows Gene really well in these conversations. It's like he doesn't believe any of it's happening. Mm-hmm. He really doesn't. It's like he does. If you say to Gene, "You can retire in 2 years," he's like, you know, it's like, mm-hmm. "I don't know about that. We'll see when we get there." But
An interesting, we should have Gene on the podcast.
I know.
God, that'd be so fun. The spouses of songwriters.
Yeah. Oh my God.
He would be so fun.
He'd be like, "You have no idea what she's put me through." No idea.
Man, I'm glad to hear that though. Mm-hmm. It'd be really nice if you lived here.
Yeah. I mean, I do feel like, as far like a lot of my friends now have signed writers and I'm staying away from it a little bit because I have two, you know, that I gave birth to that have to figure it out themselves.
Right,
so
right.
If I was like, "Hey, you guys are good, but I just signed this person," they'd be like,
God.
"Thanks, Mom."
Pain.
So, but I'm not ready for that anyway. But I love watching all my friends that are doing that now and sort of, you know, finding out how they discovered that person. And then just seeing, I mean, I've been on the road with artists where they have the writer's bus out there, and you've done this too. It's like, and they have every level. They have the guy that you know, that he's only written 50 songs his whole life. And then they have the master class writer, and just sitting in that environment and watching the songs that get written in a parking lot, you know, at an outdoor arena, you know, with Florida Georgia Line and Dan and Shay and all the writers that they have out there at every level is so exciting. And I get why established writers love to have that young blood. It's that energy is great.
I was talking to James Slater the other day, and he said these young songwriters will come in and they'll get their guitar and they're ready to go, and I'll say, hey, let's put that down for a minute. And so how does that look in your room when a young songwriter walks to you? And then on the flip side, when you go out to these pop rights and you're thinking, oh my goodness, I don't know any pop music, so sorry. But writing with, I don't know, somebody really big, and you're walking in feeling anxious, mm-hmm. how do you handle that?
Yeah, that's such a good question.
Agreed.
That's such a good question. I feel like I don't want people to be nervous. It makes me nervous if people are nervous. So I feel like when I go to those things, I try to not be nervous myself. I've been lucky that when I'm in a big room like that, I usually have a friend with me. You know, like when we went to do Star Is Born, I had Hillary and Natalie with me.
Those stories.
And Aaron Reitier, you know what I mean? So, and then I went out to write with Harry Styles and Tyler Johnson took me in. So it was like I had Tyler there. So it's like those things, usually you know someone in, like, especially in Nashville, because they know who you work well with. So be like, oh, Natalie, you should, you know, bring somebody or whatever. So, but I don't like it when people are nervous. Like, I feel bad for them, and I feel like you have no idea, you should not be nervous. So I try to not seem it myself, but of course, you know, you do end up being nervous. But and then I think my job in a co-writing session is to figure out what the song is for the day and then figure out what my hat is to wear. So if it's a writer that comes in and they have an idea and you can tell that's something they really is special to them, your job is to serve that songwriter's idea that day. And sometimes they just need somebody to make them a sandwich. Sometimes they just need somebody to tell them they're awesome. Sometimes they need somebody to just write a not great song with them that day until you get to the next time you're together. Because that's been helpful to me. Like Tony Lane, I was so afraid of Tony Lane for so long. And then I finally had him like 2 days in a row. Mm. And that really helped because I'm so afraid of Tony Lane. He's so great. He doesn't want me to be afraid of him. Mm. You know what I mean? He just wants to write a great song. And I discovered like 2 days is good. Like, because if you don't nail it on the first day, or you don't really get to show yourself the first day because you're so scared, mm-hmm. the next day you will because you're like, well, I lived through yesterday.
You may have skipped some of this stuff. It sounds like all of your first co-writes were just glorious. But like a lot of the times you're writing with people who have a chip on their shoulder because they're having to write with you. That's a big part. I remember like I was signed to Warner, my first deal. And, you know, they'd be like, if you sign here, you can write with blimps. And I'm like, really? You know, and then I'm thinking, I thought later about the conversation they had with that person. And they were like, okay, we told this girl that you'd write with her. Ooh. And they're having to write with me. And God, and a lot of them were wonderful, but I'm sure. Were you ever in a room with someone who literally was like clapping you out of the room constantly, just going like, nope, like absolutely not right. You're green. You're stupid. Like, did you ever have a write like that?
I've had writes where the person isn't listening to me for sure. But now I might say, like, are you listening to me?
I am Lori McKenna,
after Zoom,
all.
On Zoom, it's like, is my volume on? Y'all hear me? Like, but I have had a couple. And then I know those people enough that I'll be like, I need to come in with a solid idea. And then I'll just hand it over and they'll maybe write the song. But but Liz was a favorite. When she wrote with me, she was doing someone a favor.
It happens a lot.
And I remind her all the time. I'm like, don't forget. You wouldn't have me in your life. Was for that favor you did for somebody.
You paid it forward. It's true, but I mean that's such a strange part of this too, is like the who you can get in the room with in the beginning really affects your confidence. And if your publisher, knowing you've said a few things that make me think you have a great partnership with your publisher, because knowing when you're working too much, knowing that you're working with people who you've said like you attract people who just feel good and you like that confidence, like there are publishers in town who have recipes for new writers where it's practical only. You play that. Yeah. Oh, well, this person does tracks. You should write together. And there's really no sense around it because this is such an emotional exchange. But Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I get that there is a formula. Like, it's like one of those things where you should look at it, but only every now and then. Yeah. It's on the wall. It's on the it's on the blackboard, but we don't have to do everything by it. But I get why it exists. You know what I mean? Like, we wrote yesterday and I realized, like, in the room, we have the melody. So basically we have four top liners, you know what I mean? Like, trying to, you know, write this song. But I mean, I get where that, I have had experiences where they're like, you only really write good with this person and this person. So let's just stick with that. And I, you know, that never works. I'm with Creative Nation now. And Beth Lair was the one that told me, like, you have to, this artist side of you, for whatever reason, makes you a better songwriter. You should, you need to keep that alive, because there's something in you that helps you write other songs for other people and with other artists. And those people that will, like, know your they get to know your personality well enough to know, like, yeah, this is what you look like on paper, but that's not really what you are. Because everything else is those, is those formulas. Yeah. So
can I ask you an uncomfortable question that, we don't have to keep anything if it's uncomfortable. But you have 5 children. And something we talked about with Luke Dick was about how he plans, and also how his parents planned on leaving his children money, not leaving his children money. Like, the legacy you leave your children is something we are going to cover quite a bit in the book. Like, how do you... For me, my story is very different than yours, dramatically different. You know, I'm like a clenched asshole about money because of fear, you know, and luckily for me, you know, we can omit the asshole part. I'm stressed when it comes to that.
We got a good visual with that,
though. Yeah, no. It was there. It was all there, and it was real. Oh,
we're keeping it now.
It's a real-time account. No, I'm kidding.
I think the visual was really quite helpful. It was quite clear.
But people like Tracy bring me peace for the same reason, but it's like it removes a tremendous amount of fear to have people who I can trust in that world.
Yeah.
But something we talked a bunch about is, how do you not create assholes out of your children when you have, you know, you've said a couple times that songwriting isn't lucrative. It might not be as lucrative as it was in the 90s, but it's a fortune when it comes to something. Like, if I died tomorrow, my children would inherit a lot. And it scares me because I don't want them to turn into dicks. Like, that's really what it is. You have 5 children, humble and kind. Let's just read the lyrics from top to bottom. You obviously understand how to tell them how to be not assholes. But when it comes to money, like, and again, you don't have to answer it, whatever, but how do you plan to pass along your fortunes if something should happen to you, or if, you know, just you live a nice long life, you're super, super old, and then your kids, you know, inherit your money. How do you plan to do that? Or has it something that's crossed your mind?
I haven't thought that much about that, to be honest. What I would like to do is have a house near water. You know what I mean? Like, this generational thing that they can come back to. We don't have grandkids yet, but it's like, at some point we will. And it's like something that they can have. You know what I mean? That it'd be like, oh, you know, here's what came of this, you know, life well lived, you know, and hopefully have something stick with that. But I've also been around really rich people that have worked really hard to raise their children to be very modest about those things. Yes. So I've had good mentors in that respect too. And Gene has his rules. Like, every kid should drive a shit box. Like, my 17-year-old.
Yes, Gene.
Oh my God.
That's a chapter title, or at least a section.
I'm telling
quoting
you.
Him.
You should see this Jeep Patriot that my 17-year-old's driving around. Every day he leaves to go to school, I'm like, I hope it gets out of the neighborhood before it breaks down.
Every kid drives a shit box.
Yeah. there's that. But we obviously do help the kids, maybe more than we should. But every time I do something with the kids now, like a down payment for something or something, he will bark a little bit and be like, we're not raising these kids to always take care of them. But strangely, so far, at least our kids are also like want to be self-reliant and want to be, you know, want to make their own structures and things. So
isn't that nice?
It is, and that's probably just lucky, but it's probably a combination seeing a combination of the two of us.
Yes.
Too. And I always say to Gene, because we have these two kids that are creatives, right? And then we have Megan's in college, David's in high school. But our adult children, two are creatives, one's an EMT, right? So I always say to Gene, the kids learned what they learned not by watching me, but like, oh, she has this like cool job that she loves. She gets to fly places and she gets to sit in the basement and eat crackers and like play songs, like play music all day. Mm-hmm. They learned more from watching Gene, who has, you know, works 60 hours a week, wears a uniform, doesn't love his job. You know what I mean? Does his job because it feels like he has to. And I think that the two that went creative, it wasn't by watching like how easy it looked for me. It was by watching how hard it looked for Gene. So when he like, if ever that came up, like, what have you done to these children? They kind of went to Nashville. He saw us. I was like, that wasn't me. That was you.
That's not on me.
Yeah. You know what I mean?
That's incredible.
I think we learn from what we, at least that's how I'm a learner. I learn from more what I don't want to do than what I can dream I can do, you know, because my dreams have, the things that have happened to me have always been bigger than I dreamed. So I think I always learn from what I didn't want to do, you know, and brilliant. I think they have too. So,
I mean, it's amazing.
And so much of what I think of, I'm a huge fan of Humble and Kind, as you know, because that's the only requested song I had up here. And I literally just quoted it in a letter that I wrote my senior who graduated. Like, I just
love that.
A couple of pieces of it. But I think about what you're doing with your kids, Laura. It starts now.
I know.
Yeah.
Like, how you're introducing them into experiences that are going to shape who they are as people who have money and the responsibility of that. I think that just based on the what I'm hearing, reading, Humble and Kind, and now knowing Gene and the kids, you started early mentoring those kids to be who they are with or without money.
Yeah. And I think
hopefully it will come to fruition.
Yeah. If you don't have kids that think somebody's always going to hand them something, then they won't expect that in anything, including money. But I mean, when I wrote that song, there is the line about, you know, don't expect a free ride from no one. Don't hold the grudge, and here's why. And I know that I, you know, the story is that I wrote the song and I sang it on my phone and sent it to Tim. But in a lot of that was me. I've watched the McGraws with their kids.
Wow.
And I knew that we had similar, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it wasn't just that, oh, I know Tim McGraw's phone number, I'll send it to him. It was also like, I had a hunch that lyrically that they would get what I was trying to say, and that because of the way they've been so good with their kids and other people too, not just the McGraws, but people that are, you know, there's a lot of people that have a lot of money in this town. And, and you know, I had to learn that early too, when you come, like, just because your friend has a lot of money doesn't mean you have a lot of money. So be careful about that
there's
one.
There's a whole section
in that. Yeah, it's part of why I was asking
That's
about when
thing.
Like fancy people are around you. It was always so hard to not want to, like, yeah, I can totally afford this top shelf tequila. Like, early on, I would be so intimidated by everyone's wealth. And it was hard because I would want to keep up. But what's funny is the chapter section is called Keeping Up with the McGraws, which I find is so hilarious.
That is
because
funny.
We're talking about people who, you know,
none of us know.
I don't know them. You know them. And apparently they, you know, share your ethos of, you know, being humble, which is just a beautiful thing. That's fucking beautiful.
All
of that to say, I just, you're like a quintessential parent to me. I'm just to so many people
my
in
kids
this town.
Would say that.
Well, to songwriters, I know songwriters look up to you, not just because you're such a skilled songwriter, but also because of your songs reflect this sense of like groundedness, you know? And it's so the whole point of our book is to ground people. So I'm so happy we're getting this.
So thankful.
So thankful you took the time to even
sit
here.
Oh, thank you guys.
It's
so
amazing.
Fun to talk to y'all.
It is so fun. About this subject. It's so fun.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, guys.
Yay.
Oh, that was so fun.
Y'all, that's it for this week. Thank you so much to Lori McKenna.
If you haven't, please subscribe, share, rate, comment, all the above. We really appreciate it. Thank you to Luke Dick for providing the show's theme music. And thank you to American Songwriter.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.